Welcome to this evening's forum entitled Prostitutes, Pastors, and the Pentagon, a discussion on work and ethics. What I want to say very briefly is to kind of phrase a question. What does it mean to be people of God today in relationship to our work? And especially to the work of prostitutes, to the work of those people who work in defense-related industry, the euphemism is the Pentagon, and also if we need to bring in, get personal, pastors. And I asked Ingrid to set the scene a little bit with talking about prostitutes, and Jody to talk a little bit about defense matters, and we'll see if we need to get into pastors or not after that time.
Guess who doesn't want to get into pastors? Thank you, Darius. Just a few reflections on prostitutes, so we know what we're talking about. In Chicago, at least, the profession is referred to among the participants as the life, which I think is an interesting image. I think probably we're dealing with prostitutes tonight because it is such a useful image for Christians. It comes up all the time. And the fact that they refer to one another as being in the life always has echoes for me of being the way, the truth, and the life. And there's lots of stuff about the life. It's in capital letters. So bear that in mind. There are those who call it a victimless crime, and along people who make that argument say that prostitution is selling love, as opposed to people who work for the Pentagon who sell destruction and violence and hate and war and bombs and stuff. And obviously it's not selling love, is it? It's selling their bodies. So if you go along with it being victimless, you could say, well, they're selling their bodies and making a living. The same way maybe a social service person cares about his or her clients, or a psychiatrist cares about the person that is laying their soul bare for him. A prostitute lays their body bare for him. You know, I mean, the prostitute takes care of a certain physical need and does it in a, sometimes I suppose if it's well done, does it in a caring way. And you hire that done, the way you would hire someone to listen to you or hire your pastor to listen to you, maybe. I mean, you know, maybe it's a social service. A lot of people make parallels between prostitutes and unloved and unloving wives. Wives give sex for security. You know, there's an economic transaction that takes place in some marriages that's sort of sex, and I expect cooking and cleaning or something, and economic security. So that's another way of looking at it, as a victimless crime. It's often a victim-filled crime. They're often, I go to women's court in Chicago with my classes sometimes. I do classes in women and work, and we go to women's court. It's named women's court, and it's the court of prostitution. And you see the prostitutes get herded in groups of about 30 at a time to be tried. And they, you know, each one gets 30 seconds in front of the judge. Now and then the judge will take an interest and spend 2 minutes with one. And those are victims. I mean, many of them are. They're on drugs, they're teenagers, they're burned out hulks of human beings. Their eyes are blank and they look horrible. So if you say there's no victim, it's not the case. The prostitutes are the victims under those circumstances.
We don't usually prosecute victims of crimes.
No, that's true.
Keep that thought and we may move into that.
It's real painful to sit with them. I mean, it's really tough to do. There are lots of famous madams, and in literature, and apocryphally, and in the Bible, madams and prostitutes, and they've done fabulous things. And in fact, I know of madams in Chicago who have taken in runaway teens and protected them from the life, kept them out of the life, but protected them, taken care of them, let them live in their brothel, made space for children to be safe there, made space for teens to be safe there, protected old alcoholic men that are their friends and made space for them to be safe there. They're loving, often very loving people. You know, some prostitutes have their act fairly together and are given a halo. I mean, they're blessed, they're beautiful, they're wonderful. They take care of their neighbors. And certainly, when you think about poor people in Chicago, at least, and especially people of color who are poor in Chicago, one out of every four who starts kindergarten in Chicago graduates and is able to read. And the other three were pushed out along the way or quit, or if they did finish, they can't read. And they mostly have records. If you grow up in the ghetto in Chicago, you get a record. Just by standing on a corner, you get a record. You get picked up for something, you get prosecuted. It's what the common stuff that's said about that in the ghetto in Chicago is what goes around comes around. You probably don't get prosecuted for the actual loaf of bread you stole, but you get prosecuted for someone else's loaf of bread that someone else stole. And in any case, you've got a record. So once you have a record and you can't read or write and you don't have an education and you're black and you're poor, there are not many ways to make a living. And the kind of money you can get on public aid is not enough to live on. It's just very, very hard to live on public aid. It takes all of your public aid just to pay your rent. And then you've got to feed your kids and stuff like that. So then a lot of people go into the life because they have to, because that's a way to make money. Who's to say that it's wrong to feed your children? Jesus is not very down on prostitutes. We are. Using the word prostitute is something that we do as a way of saying the lowest form of human life on earth. That's the standard for what's the worst. That is whenever we want to say that the person is the worst, of the worst character, the worst lifestyle, the worst kind of human being, we say prostitute or harlot or whatever. It's the example of how bad it can get. And it's not the case. I mean, you can't do that to any group of human beings, and you certainly can't do it to prostitutes. And Jesus didn't do it to prostitutes. Lots of instances in the Bible, prostitutes, harlots are raised up as being models of something wonderful, something good, some strong thing in their character, or some way that they've been given real grace and beauty. And so it's sort of interesting that we choose that so-called crime of doing that physical thing as the standard for what's the worst. Those are some ideas I had about it. I don't have any answers or solutions or any great truths, but I just think that it's an interesting set of images for us to use in our discussion tonight. It's not black and white. It's not clear.
Jody, thank you.
Well, I certainly follow Ingrid right there. I have absolutely no answers. But I do want to push us from the experience of Women's Court in Chicago to thinking about public ways of discussing work and its value. I think out of some sessions we've had here this week, Karen Stickland's on The White Train, and think about Al Pitcher's on Habits of the Heart, we've come to, those at least are two of the roots of tonight's discussion, come to rethink a little bit this week at Holden whether or not there are public standards by which one can judge the work, not only of oneself, but of others as well. Al talked, when he talked about Habits of the Heart, as that being a well-developed argument that more and more of the world as we live it in the United States, particularly in the middle class in the United States, has been privatized. And that certainly seems to me to be absolutely clear about the world of work. Bob Bella and the others in that book remind us that the notion of jobs as self-fulfilling and as self-expressive is a fairly recent notion, and that it really does not have a whole lot of biblical or older ethical resonance, certainly not the way Luther thought about work, for instance. The privatization of the world of work has meant mostly that we can't talk with each other about standards to which we could all be held in our work, right? Work pretty much is okay as long as it doesn't directly harm somebody else and fulfills the self and feeds the family. There's been, a marked decline in this century of public discussion of work. We've got a lead back into that, it seems to me, that we all know about, that I just want to remind us of here. And it's again an expression of our growing debt, it seems to me, to the Catholic bishops. We haven't been in the last 50 years in this country always in debt to the Catholic bishops as the leaders of our rethinking our social position, but we certainly have been, it seems to me, growingly in the last 5 or 6 years. And it was, of course, Bishop Mathiasen of Amarillo, Texas, who raised probably in the most graphic way the question of whether or not there was some kind of a basic value clash between the Christian faith, as Catholics understood it, the expression of God's will in the world of work, and work in a nuclear arms plant. So he told his constituents, as you recall, a couple years ago, that he didn't think that a Catholic, in good conscience, could work in a munitions plant that was making nuclear weapons. That seems to me to be an awfully courageous and groundbreaking kind of stand for a pastor of a flock to take, and it certainly was. It certainly jarred me into rethinking the public domain in which we can think about our work. What are the limits of socially acceptable work? Can we talk about that once again as a public kind of discussion? What are the social impacts of what it is we do? Can we talk about those as being just as important as the self-expression and the self-fulfillment? Hunthausen, in an agonizing series of writings and speeches, as I recall them, just gut-wrenching. You could sort of feel his struggle with every sentence. Simply thought this one job, out of the thousands of job categories in the United States, the manufacture of parts for nuclear weapons, was out of the pale of acceptable moral work.
Joey Hunthausen?
I'm sorry, did I say Hunthausen?
You said right.
Mathiasen. So he opened up that discussion for all of us, it seems to me. It's got a lot of questions that attach to it. I'm not very comfortable coming down very, very hard on one side or another of those questions. It certainly asks us to consider how in the world, what are our criteria? How do we isolate the categories of work that need that kind of moral stricture put upon? Is there a qualitative difference between that one job and everything else that people do in the United States? What's the difference between that and tobacco farming? What else could we put in that kind of a category? I have a problem with the thinking about Mathiasen's position in terms of social and economic class. That is, there is a kind of position of privilege here, a kind of position of moral privilege given to those people who are secure enough to know that we've got jobs, right? And many people working in that plant, and this is part of the agony that Mathiasen went through at that point, didn't have all of the job options that a lot of the rest of us have. In general, though, it seems to me a very instructive case to begin a rediscussion, finally, long overdue, it seems to me, of the public consequences of our work and whether or not there are any possible areas of agreement on ethical standards that we can judge each other and our work by. Just stop there.
A couple other points. Mathiasen also makes the case that if you do quit and you don't have a job, it is the duty of the Christian community to provide for that person until that person gets back into the flow of society in some way. And so what is that responsibility? And if a prostitute quits, what's our responsibility as the Christian community during that time? And a couple of just things on pastors so you know that we'll get into it. And this is basically triggered from, we've been talking about prostitutes in one sense with Hosea this week. But also in Kierkegaard, I remember one quote that Ron said, that pastors will be in heaven what prostitutes are here.
Pastors won't be needed.
Well, that's another way of looking at it. Pastors won't be needed, but okay. Yeah. And the other thing is that I think that lots of times we water down the gospel so that we practice what we preach. I cannot practice the gospel, so I water the gospel down to conform to my standards so I can practice what I preach. And Kierkegaard, in tonight's one of his quotes, says that what we do is preach mediocrity at that point. And we live under an illusion. And what should be our witness to these two illustrations about work and ethics and anything else that we may want to get into tonight. So, just little hooks to hook some thoughts on to now take off into an open discussion, to challenge, to debate, to argue, to laugh, to cry together.
What did he mean by the first statement? I mean, I understood the second one. The first one about ministers would be in heaven, what prostitutes are. What's the meaning?
Well, I thought he meant with that we will be as despised in heaven as the cult
pastors.
Of pastors. Me. I will be as despised in heaven as the general public despises prostitutes here on earth. That's how I took it. There may be some other people who took it differently. It's not a very pleasant thought.
Not you, Darius.
Yeah, I'm the exception.
That was kind of a comic thing in the papers, wasn't it? Kind of a joke, as I recall it.
Yeah, all jokes have truth in them.
Yeah. I don't know if Kierkegaard ever joked without meaning something behind it. But yes?
I have two things to say, not anything direct, but one is that I heard some things about how a lot of women get kind of hurt in the business of prostitution, and that the pimps kind of go looking for women who look vulnerable, and then, they kind of sweet talk them into going for a ride with them, and they're mass raped and beat up and drugged, and that a lot of women who are in prostitution aren't even in by choice, as I would think of choice in the ideal sense of the word. And another thing is...
That's true.
Yeah. And then another thing that somebody said in a kind of a speech that I thought was a good point, and I'm sure it's been made before, but she said that women are told to proceed with caution, knowing that in their lives they have... they may be raped, and that meanwhile the pornography industry is told to go on and proceed business as usual. And so I just thought I'd mention the pornography industry and that comparison with prostitution.
It's another P. Pimps and pornography. Yeah, yeah. And I wonder how many people in the weapons industry as well are lured into it without really knowing what they're getting into. And really, what part, living in New Mexico for a long time, Los Alamos Labs and Sandia Labs, you don't even know what the final product is. You're working on such a small portion, you can say, well, I don't think I'm working on that. You can live in your own illusion. And I wonder how that works with prostitutes or our own jobs.
Two things to support what you're saying. Now, obviously, I wasn't around when it happened, but it's my understanding that those who created the first atomic bomb didn't even know they were doing it, which is, they didn't really know. I mean, they might have had a hint. And I don't remember when or where I read this, but it was about a jobs training program for those on public aid. And this person, teaching business skills and clerical skills to this person, and there's sort of a personal testimony. Oh, this is great, wonderful. And she's employed by Martin Marietta, one of a large defense contractor. And all of a sudden I realized, and this person has a lot of pride in herself because she can feed her family, which is something she hadn't been able to do. And can I tell that person it's wrong for her to work for a defense agency?
Is it wrong to work for a defense agency? Is it wrong to be a prostitute?
I have friends in this defense industry, as they call it, and they're completely happy by knowing that what they're making will never be used.
You feel that, or you think
no,
they
I
feel that?
Feel. They go home at 5 o'clock and say, what you're doing will never be used, so what's wrong with it?
There's more probability that a handgun that's made to sell as a Friday night special will be used to kill 8 people and used to the atomic bombs.
Can you imagine an artist creating a creation that nobody will see, what that must feel like? Yeah.
I had the privilege of doing defense work at one time, and I did not join that necessarily by my own choice. And in the times as I was thinking about ways I could escape this fight, I also thought that it was good that I was there rather than only being an enlisted force, because if there were people like me there, I hopefully could give them some rational choices and some conscience. And I thought to myself, if the people who were joint, who were beside me and who liked this and joined this and kept re-upping, that if those were the only people allowed in the military, that this could be even more dangerous than it is now. So if we deny those people who have the moral thoughts, access to those industries, then are we not creating a greater Frankenstein than before?
I read an interview of somebody who got out of it after agonizing reflection, because he says somewhere along the line, I lost my innocence. And that innocence was to raise my hand and say, what we are doing is not right. And I wonder how many of us say that when we're working in that industry, or a lot of others in the ministry and other areas.
Well, I'm a tributary into that stream. I'm a college professor, you know. Should I flunk all my students, so that all my science students, so they can't go on and work in advanced nuclear science stuff? You know, maybe my little contribution would be to flunk all my science students. You know, I'm a tributary into that stream. All of us are in one way or another. We all buy products from companies that make armaments. You never even know whether the product you're buying is made by a company that also makes nuclear weapons.
You say something's wrong because it is the most frightening thing in your life, or because it kills the most people? You know, drug industry, where they produce far more drugs than they could ever be given normally by prescription, far more tranquilizers, far more pain medication than could ever be given by prescription, and they have an inkling that it's being sold on the street, but they do nothing to regulate it. And you know, you say, well, it's okay because I'm working in the medical industry and I'm saving the world.
Because if we would regulate it, then the people who might need it, we might have a shortage.
Yes, I mean,
that's
and
the rationale.
It's,
yeah,
you know, like 100,000 times the amount they could possibly use, because they show, you know, just bins and bins full of drugs that they say, you know, and you know, this small portion will be used in hospitals. The rest of this is sold on the street or acquired through doctors that say, I'll just take 200, do I care? And they just give mass prescriptions repeatedly.
And isn't it true with the weapons industry, the United States is the number one seller, exporter of arms? Whether you get into the whole nuclear issue, but we are selling before, you know, it's good money, and maybe, you know, and what's who do we sell to and who don't we sell to and all that sort of stuff.
Don't we daily have small choices that we can make, whether to strip humanity from someone or to degrade a person? It seems like it can also be on a very, very small scale in each of our occupations, that there's choices that we make that are uplifting, or that we can leave people flat.
Yeah.
I think in a sense we all prostitute ourselves, or we all have that choice to make.
Yeah, or how often do I pimp another person, too?
There was a day at women's court once when a group of my 21-year-old white liberal arts college students from St. Olaf and Concordia and Valparaiso were talking with a bevy of prostitutes who had just gotten out of court. And we were all in the hall outside the court. And the prostitutes were so turned on at the idea that they had something to give to us, that they would, you know, we went on and on talking. They were sharing, they were telling about the life. They were so excited that they were givers in a teaching way. And then they offered to take my students out on the street and teach them how to do it.
Yeah. How many of them accepted?
Classified information.
I'm really bothered by these statements that are made. They say, boy, since we bombed Libya and all this, our present popularity has gone way up. And then I hear these other statements, and they swear that they've taken a poll and that this is the way it is. And I don't know anybody that agrees with this, but the paper says that the 80% think this is good. And it's all the way along in all of these issues. And this, to me, is the big thing. I know I'm being lied to. I know these statistics aren't true. But it seems like there's any way there to fight this. It's the lie. It's the big lie.
And then it raises a whole other question. What then should be our work in relationship to this? Not only what do I do for my, quote, living, my dollars, but how do you combat some of that stuff if you believe that way? There's a hand back here somewhere.
I've got a question that always disturbs me is, where does the responsibility lie? I mean, Ingrid, for example, is it her responsibility if her students go into nuclear research and create more weapons? Or is it their responsibility? Or is it a little bit of both? And it's the same with pharmaceutical companies. Is it really their responsibility if somebody takes, or is it the person who takes the medication, or is it the doctor's responsibility? And I know for myself, a lot of times when I have a problem with something or someone, sometimes this is not my problem. I've got a difficulty with a relationship to, I don't have a problem, this other person does. There's nothing I can do. And I think, where is the responsibility? Where does the blank fall?
Is that responsibility society, the pimp, the church, our welfare system, in relationship to a whole lot of things, yeah.
And also, how do we, if I just said, yes, I have some responsibility here, how do I go about being responsible? And we have, maybe I'm in a position where I can actually, I'll stay with this defense company and maybe I can change something. Or I'll stay in politics even though I know everybody else is corrupt because maybe I can do some good. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are ways to be responsible in those positions.
And as far as what I know about the University of New Mexico, it's much more seductive too, because the way you can get grants to do research now is to get government grants that are very narrowly defined and definitely defense related in some way or not, and for the sake of research. And we all know that anything one discovers can be used for good or evil. And it's not my responsibility as a researcher to decide how it should be used, but it's my responsibility to make this thing in order that it's hoped to be used for good. So goes one argument. So it's not my responsibility. We pass the buck to parents elsewhere. Yes?
Let me turn it a little bit differently, because I don't know how many people here work for a nuclear manufacturing company. What if you're working for someone that you think is not nice and who you feel is evil? Now, I'm in a business where I see all kinds of people, and occasionally I come upon a person, and I don't like them very much, but they pay their bill very, very quickly, and that's seduction to me. That's true seduction. They'll pay the bill before I even give it to them. And they're evil people. I can sense it. What their business is not nice. That's, I see, is a greater risk. Then I'm never going to be associated with someone that manufactures bonds. I'm never going to be associated in what I do with Boeing or any of these other major issues in the world. I'm going to be associated with people, individuals, and individual businesses, and some of them aren't nice.
You're riding in the Boeing airplane?
Good. Good. Yeah. Yeah. Good. Good question, though. Here and then over here.
How many of you would like to have no army, no navy? None. In this world today.
In the whole world?
In the whole world.
Not our country has no. We have the ability to have no military in our country. We don't have the ability to choose what they do.
No. I was asking the question, how many would like to have the United States of America have no army, no navy, no marines, no guns?
Just the United States and none of the other countries, or all the countries?
Just the United States.
He's asking just the United States. That's.
And you know what would happen?
Of course, the other side of that.
I don't know if that would happen. Yeah. We all been told that was going to happen. But we don't know if that's going to happen. And it'd be nice if all that money was pumped into other things. We'd have no ghettos, maybe. And we would have, everyone would have a better way of life here where people would see us as an example. We don't know what would happen.
Of course, it's maybe not be black and white. Maybe it's not no. Maybe it's 10% reduction, 20%, 30%, name whatever you want, you know, too. But there's a comment over here.
Well, I'm sitting here asking myself a question. How do I feed into the system? I think similar to your question. And the one thing that occurs to me that's real close to home is denial systems. And I ask myself, what are my own denial systems? What do I deny about myself? What do I deny about it? And somehow, I believe that on, I don't want to use the word cosmic, but there's some kind of level where my decision to deny, which has nothing to do with nuclear weapons, actually on some kind of energetic level feeds into that whole denial system that's a larger framework. And I guess what I'd like to say is I feel a deep responsibility to look very honestly at my own life and my own relationships and my own community, like honest to the core. And that at least makes me feel like I can do something.
In response to your question about if you would like to say if you don't want to have an arm, I was just going to say, what about New Zealand? Because they don't participate in the military. I don't believe they have any.
Not in the nuclear. No, they have conventional.
Yeah.
Of course. Yeah.
I stopped and had lunch at a lunch counter outside of Army base in New Zealand last November.
But are we denying the reality? You know, we could say we're denying the reality of the Soviets, but also are we making it so black and white that we're denying that we might be able to reduce our arms somewhat? Are we? Robert Lifton, a psychological historian, says that the number one neurosis in the world today, or at least in the United States, is psychological numbing. That we no longer can perceive the difference between Hill Street Blues and the evening news. We have the same sort of emotional or non-emotional reaction. And what's the denial mechanisms in the world of the prostitutes and in the world of the defense and in the world of the church, you know, and in our own individual lives? I think that's a crucial. How do we start feeling again something?
It seems like we're having a hard time talking about what is good work or what is bad work. And I'm interested in that question. I'm not sure I know how to talk about it either. But I wonder whether we could try to talk about something we know for sure is bad work or we know for sure is good work. Maybe it'd be easier to talk about what is good, clearly good work. How do you feel about your own work? Is your work good work? Or is your work bad work? And if so, do you have any thoughts about why it's one thing or the other?
Let me just say that I think that's a problem, Ingrid. That's a kind of either-or question that I think we've been getting into a problem with in the last 10 minutes of the discussion here. That it seems to me that one problem that discussions of morals in the United States always has is the assumption that there's such a thing as being morally pure. You know, that you can talk realistically about a world of no weapons. You probably can't, you know. But we're so disturbed by the thought about ourselves that our hands are dirty. Mm-hmm. I'm not disturbed about that. I'm a social being. I'm part of this culture. I am part of everything this culture is. My hands are dirty from the day I'm born. Right? I think we need to accept that and think about things in degrees. It doesn't mean that we can't think about ethics and morals, but it does seem to me that we've got to get out of the trap of thinking that there is something that's, you know, notably good work, mm-hmm. and something else that's notably bad work.
But are there some things of my work that is good, mm-hmm. and some things of my work which is bad, to get at the same
thing? Certainly a large part of good work is work that makes you good. It makes mm-hmm. you feel productive, it makes you feel fulfilled, it makes you feel like you're not hiding your light under a bushel, it makes you feel like a contributing human being.
Christ as an example, you say light under, not hiding your light under a bushel, sort of a Christ-like work.
Ooh, does anybody get that?
I think I do.
Oh, she raised her hand.
Now, when we get into semantics like this, I have a problem with that, only because oftentimes people feel that if they don't feel the calling to the vocation of something within the church, then their life isn't fulfilled or worthwhile. And I believe as a teacher that I am called to be that, and to me that the worst thing I can do is not acknowledge that and be open to that and say, oh, you know, this is truly my calling, and to deny that or say, forgive it, I'm not going to do that, is to me not being Christ-like. Christ-like for me is being a teacher in a public school, which is a pit sometimes, but I used to think that being Christ-like was being a missionary or working at Holden Village or Siberia to do whatever, and it's not those things. So if we're going to talk about that kind of thing, well, I really would have a problem with just saying I would be Christ-like. It's Christ-like every day and everything I do with every person I meet.
If I look at the work I do, I teach young children, and there's lots of good that I do, and I can enjoy that and feel good about it, but there's things that I'm called to do as a teacher that I hate: grading children or conforming them to a group of standards that are not healthy at times, but for the sake of the group, we do. Or just activities that I'm called to instruct in. And I do them because it's part of the list of things that I do. Maybe I don't put my whole heart into them. Maybe I try to counteract them with my own set of extras. And that's not nuclear war, but it's a child.
I try to focus on, does my work can be used for good or for bad? First of all, I say to myself, do I feel good about it? And then do I say, does my work build something better? And if it doesn't, I try not to do it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It seems as though Jesus would want us to look and say, is what I'm doing bringing glory to God? And that can be any job we have. You know, working in a restaurant, a teaching school, a salesman. One particular profession that I would have problems with would be prostitution. Because in the word it says, I think in Galatians, you know, those who practice sin, you know, sexual immorality. To me, that would be practicing sexual immorality. If a person came to know the Lord and continued in that, I think, you know, that would be a problem. You know, we want to love the person, but we can't necessarily say what you're doing is good. But, you know, love the person and pray for them. But to me, that would be one job that I think the Lord speaks to.
Mm-hmm. And the question is, how do we love the person at that point? What does that mean,
right.
I would say. Ingrid, you want to?
Oh, David, yeah. I think has something.
Oh, okay.
Well, just I don't want to, you know, I think one of the distinctions that Calvin and Luther made, I think it's very important to make that. You know, Calvin liked to talk about doing the work for the glory of God. Luther used to say, don't ever say that, please. You know, because that's just what Christ is all over. If you want to say that your work ought to be serving your fellow human beings, that's something else. And I think that's one of the traps that we get into. If we don't have it in that dimension, then I think we just, you know, we just are going at it, over-spiritualizing work again that Seth Sturkel says you can't do.
Yeah, just right over here, please.
This isn't really an original thought, but at a family camp that was at 2 years ago in Grahamsburg, Wisconsin, the lecturer addressed this somewhat in saying that thinking of yourself as part of the community and every person has their own talents. So you use your own talents and your job to contribute to the good of the community, and hopefully whether this is the church or whatever, that it will ultimately contribute to the better good of everyone. And I like that thought real well.
In relation to that, we learned, at least I learned once again in the Kierkegaard class, that following Jesus wants Jesus saves you, but following Jesus, so doing whatever works you're going to be doing, isn't the thing that saves, you know, doesn't save you. That's we get trapped in that too.
But nothing is pure white like this.
That's for sure.
There's a teacher over here, and we have 20 kids in school, and she helps them. They become brighter. They learn. They grow up. They remember. And then they go and work in the munitions factory, or they become pimps, or they become prostitutes, or they become preachers, or what? What is your good and bad part in that? Is there a bad part? Do you condemn yourself for being a teacher because some of those kids are going to become prostitutes?
I don't think it's under control.
There you are. And so that's the best answer I've heard tonight. There's some things of which we want to control but cannot. All you as a teacher here, or you as a teacher at the university level do, is help them realize their best potential, which might be thwarted over to killing. Yeah, yeah. So,
is that their best potential?
Do you condemn yourself? No, the students you're teaching,
should she
be condemned? might go to munitions, but they also might discover a cure for it.
Yeah. Comment back here.
I'm not sure that I can help my students realize their fullest potential without personal biases entering into that. In my school, the status symbol is being pregnant at 16 and unmarried. In their community, that is an accepted norm, and that is a big thing for me to help them realize their fullest potential. In my opinion, it's obviously not for them to be mothers at 16 and sexually active at that age. But you know, I agree that's neat if we could do that, but boy, sometimes my personal values come through loud and clear in a situation like that. And I do have to bite my tongue and say, this is my norm, this is my culture is a little different, my upbringing and what I bring to these kids is so totally different from what they're bringing to me. And that can really be, imposing my values on another person is really easy thing to do because you can do it just by your existence. So.
One of the things we try to do with our college students, and we have them in Chicago, is to make them self-critical about the question of vocation. That is, if by then they have, most of them have some kind of professional direction. And one of the things we try to do with them is to show them the downside, ethically, of that profession. And they all have it, right? The medical profession certainly does in various ways, the law and so on. And it's really important, it seems to me, that we're going to get better lawyers and doctors if they have thought about and been exposed to the downside of that profession. the worst that it can do. I mean, clergy ought to do that too.
I taught a course in medical ethics to nursing students once, seniors, and halfway through the course, we had about half the group were going to be dropping out of nursing, you know, and we realized we were doing the downside too heavy, we thought, and if we were or not, that's another whole thing.
Yeah, well, it's not okay to do it.
Yeah.
You really have to support people.
Yeah, right.
You need to get defensive.
When I think about what makes my vocation feel like my life is perfect, from the inside, it's that I've chosen it. I've had two professions so far, and one I don't feel like I really chose, and then the second one I feel like I really chose. And the choice part has to do with looking at the downside. I mean, just looking at the full scope and saying, yeah, knowing this, I choose to do this. And I don't know quite where that fits in, but there's an element of taking responsibility for the whole picture, or taking responsibility and choosing it, that somehow fits in here, but I'm not sure where. Mm-hmm.
Whatever I do, let me put it this way. In Deuteronomy, it says, you know, I put before you blessing and curse, you know, life and death, choose life. When my daughter walks up to my bed at 5-6 in the morning and says, morning, and I pick her up, throw her back into her bed and say, go to sleep, I have chosen death, I think. When I can see myself to say morning to her and get up and help to make pancakes, and we make a mess, it's the most glorious time that we, it's those rare moments. I have chosen life at that time. And, you know, and I think that same parallel is in lots of everyday, workaday world, wherever we go. What do we do to help other people hope? How do we guard each person's dignity? And how do we rob people of dignity? How do we rob them of having some sort of sense of a future? In no matter what profession we're in or they're in. And then, you know, that's all I can do. And I don't do that. I kill a lot in many different ways. Yeah.
One profession that comes to mind is the attorney. And it's been said that if you want to know if an attorney's lying, watch his lips.
Can you say the same about preachers?
Yeah. This guy is, well, we had an instance in San Diego not long ago, a couple of years ago, where a fellow walked into McDonald's and opened fire and killed a bunch of people. The attorney, this is a hypothetical case, but the attorney is a real good attorney. We'll say Melvin Belli or somebody like that, caliber. Gets this fellow off through chicanery or however he wants to do it. He's classified as an excellent attorney because he gets this guy off, gets him out on the street. Now, has he done a good job for society?
Mm-hmm. Back to day one of the Bible study, righteousness and doing right. You know, what was righteousness in that behavior? And isn't the attorney's job to do that, to defend that person? Otherwise, I could be, you know, in that sense. Yeah,
this really
it's a tough question.
It bothers me that he's turned this man loose on society.
I found that I have to make a distinction between I cannot be responsible for any other human being in the world, not even my own children. There are numerous people too that I can be responsible to. And as an attorney, it is not an attorney's job, any more than a doctor's, to decide whether the man is guilty or innocent. Mm-hmm. He brings that to the judge to make that decision. His responsibility is to his client,
but he doesn't
who is entitled to the best defense he can give him. Mm-hmm.
And so with research, weapons, and yeah, it's interesting.
All is tied to money. Mm-hmm. If he's rich, he's going to have that really good attorney. Mm. If he's not, forget it.
Interesting. Okay, yeah. Chuck.
I was just reflecting on how some occupations seem to change through the centuries. To Luther, the
the calling that was condemned was not the, that of the soldier. But Luther didn't know the nuclear situation. The weapons of mass destruction was not an issue. In Luther's time, soldiers fought against soldiers. They didn't fight against civilians. They didn't kill civilians en masse. But Luther condemned, as I recall, most severely, the usurer. The one who made a living by charging interest on money. And that today is fully acceptable. It's become part of our whole system. All of us benefit from it. We all live by it. Our pensions depend on it. We wouldn't have pensions in the church, Darius.
Without interest. I think you're right on.
But I sometimes wonder when I look at the international debt problem, if we ought not be more censorious about the usurer today, the charging of interest, and the unwillingness to renegotiate loans and so on and bring the rates down. I don't want to muddy it by adding another occupation here, but I have. Yeah.
I just want to comment that I have real interest in ethics in the workplace, and I don't know if it's fortunate or not, but I am an attorney. And another seminar that I went to, the same thing came up. And so, you know, I feel like, I'm not sure if we're addressing the questions there. I don't feel like, I guess maybe there are no answers. But, so what, how does an attorney witness in the workplace? Or what do you do to work for the glory of God? You know, what does anybody do? What is that answer? If you're going to condemn any particular profession, whether it's prostitution or whatever, what are the answers? What is anyone to do? But I don't hear any answers. Not that, that I feel like I can incorporate.
You may be a cop-out, but I know Paul and Luther always thought, you know, all of us have failed and fallen short of the glory of God, and you know, and all that sort of stuff. And it's by the grace of God that we even, you know, that we continue. Thomas Merton says, sometimes I feel like I'm traveling through my destiny in a belly of a paradox. Mm-hmm. You know? Sometimes, and somebody else says, what we're challenged to do is live the contradiction. And we want everything nice and easy. You know, if I can figure it all out this way, and who has the white hats and who has the black hats, who's the good and who's the bad, then I'll know how to act. And the problem is, once I've thought that, and I think I'm on the right side, I'm on the wrong side. Like, I think. That's just my bias. There's a comment back. Okay, over here.
Well, just a brief comment. In the Nuremberg trials, I think world opinion agreed with the condemnation, especially of European German judges who made minute decisions and favored the regime in their judicial decisions. And some of them were very self-critical of themselves later on when they had a chance to assess that. I think all of us then in that case would say there is such a thing as seeking to do right. And I don't purport to give answers to attorneys. I have an attorney friend who's listening quietly from the next floor. But I think the least that we should surely say to one another is that calling of righteousness, whatever that is, right relations, has got to be one of the norms in our social order. And so somehow it seems to me I'd like to hear us articulate the need for aiming toward that. Some people are a lot more desirous to aim for that than others, and those who are need to encourage one another to do that. It doesn't make the solutions easy. Mm-hmm. But we surely need encouragement to do that. And it's very easy for self-interest to cave in a little bit. And it's very easy for us to tell other people they ought to do better. They ought to disinvest, they ought to do this, and they ought to do that. It's hard for me to start where I am and to say that's going to be my commitment. And I appreciate the words from those who point to themselves and say, how do I deal with my dilemma? And I think I find my best help when people encourage me how concretely in my vocation or whatever to aim for that. And I would like to get some response if that's a helpful kind of...
You stirred two hands going up part way through, so I think you've already done it. Yeah, here and then over here.
Well, I don't know if it speaks exactly to that, but you know, Richard had this thing about saying, and really, you know, said, do it as excellently as you can. I mean, just do the job as well as you possibly can, and then immerse yourself in the forgiveness of sins. Just you have to. I mean, there's no other way to do that. And I find that helpful, you know, a little bit along the line of righteousness, you know, seeking righteousness and so forth. The other thing that's hopeful to me, and maybe this is a very awful meaning, but you referred to areas, this Minnesota study for the area yesterday, and you know, that is one of the most amazing things that I've ever seen in the last 20 years, because in that study, the one thing that is a bright spot is that there, I can't remember the exact figures now, but something around 70% of the people in I presume most of Marlupin, said they really felt that they were in a job where they felt they were helping other human beings. Well, about 50% said they thought they were in a job that through their baptism, as this theological one, that they somehow felt that God had destined them to do that job. Well, that's incredible. I don't think 20 years ago anybody even thought about those things. So at least maybe the church is making some headway in this kind of thing, and we're beginning to ask ourselves serious questions about other than the church progression.
And the study or the book, I think it's Augsburg Publishers, the book, I think Faith and Ferment, if any of you are interested in looking at that. Right here and then back here.
The devil made me do it. He's clever, awfully clever.